The explosive new film, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, exposes secrets behind the government's takedown of General Michael Flynn.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
He told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire. They had to get rid of Flynn.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.
Welcome to The Christian Outlook, the weekly radio program that sorts through the issues of our fast-changing world in a way that honors your Christian faith. Sponsored by the Pepperdine Graduate School of Public Policy. I'm Georgine Rice. This week, the nation prepares for a new Supreme Court justice.
Can you provide a definition for the word woman?
I can't.
What does this apparent confusion say about the judge and about our cultural moment?
Society has had no problem in defining what makes a male and a female for thousands of years. It's incredible that it's suddenly become so complicated.
In the face of all the cultural pressure, a growing number of Christians are deconstructing. Michael Youssef of Leading the Way responds.
Deconstruction is just a polite way of saying they've become an apostate.
As the nation grows increasingly polarized on abortion, leading corporations have started subsidizing what you could call abortion tourism. Case in point, Citigroup.
It kind of looks like they're trying to show off how progressive they are.
Maryland and California legislators pursue legislation that would, analysts argue, open the door to infanticide.
It's okay for a mother to just allow a child to die. That's exactly what the legislation would have allowed.
All this and more. I'm Georgine Rice. I'm glad to be with you once again. I'm coming to you from Portland and my home station of KPDQ. You can hear my own program live each weekday afternoon on 93.9 FM here in Portland and online via our website at kpdq.com and also through the TuneIn radio app. Take a moment to follow the Christian Outlook on Twitter at TC Outlook. That's TC Outlook. Thanks for joining us. We'll start in Washington, D.C., and Judge soon-to-be Justice Ketanji Brown Jackson. The process unfolded with a bit more tough questioning than many expected. Republicans in the Senate knew they didn't have the votes to stop her nomination, and yet Jackson's soft-on-crime record, including a reduced sentence for a man convicted of child pornography charges, raised legitimate concerns about her approach to the law. But what will be long remembered is her very revealing interchange with Tennessee Senator Marsha Blackburn.
Can you provide a definition for the word woman?
Can I provide a definition?
Mm-hmm.
No.
Yeah.
I can't.
You can't?
Not in this context.
So
I'm not a biologist.
The meaning of the word woman is so unclear and controversial that you can't give me a definition?
Senator, in my work as a judge, what I do is I address disputes. If there's a dispute about a definition, people make arguments and I look at the law and I decide.
Well,
so I'm not.
The fact that you can't give me a straight answer about something as fundamental as what a woman is underscores the dangers of the kind of progressive education that we are hearing about.
The interchange reveals as much about our moment in history as it does about Judge Jackson. Kathy Emmons and John Hall, my colleagues in Pittsburgh, turned to theologian Carl Truman from The Ride Home on Word 101.5 FM.
Of course, you're writing about Supreme Court nominee Ketanji Brown Jackson. She made waves with her refusal to provide a definition for the word woman. Now, responding to Senator Marsha Blackburn, Jackson sidestepped the question, stating, "I'm not a biologist." That raised a lot of different ire, depending upon what side of the aisle you're on. But I guess, you know, to sidestep that and say, I'm not a biologist, what does that mean to you, Carl, whenever you hear someone say, what is a woman, and someone says, well, I'm not a biologist?
Well, it was amusing in an odd way, because clearly what she was trying to do was dodge the question, I think, in order not to alienate what we might broadly call the trans lobby. But in deferring the question to biologists, she seemed to be conceding that there is a biological definition of woman out there. It's just not one that she has grasped or is able to articulate in a clear and concise fashion, which is precisely what the trans lobby would wish to deny. that, for want of a better word, gender is a state of mind. It's not a state of one's biological body. So when we have no sort of broader agreed moral framework for talking about these things or differentiating between different acts, then really we are subject to whatever the tastes of the moment happen to be, whatever the crowd happens to declare is moral or legitimate. So we find ourselves unhitched, really, and floating on a sea of public opinion, for want of a better term. And public opinion tends to be shaped by those who shout loudest and have the best grasp of the media that shape public opinion, things like Twitter, YouTube, TikTok, etc.
Right. So, Carl, in my reading, I'm reading about the general population of what it is to be a trans woman. I think, I don't know if this is true or not, but the population in the United States is 0.7%, which, of course, is a very, very tiny percentage. But as you look and we all read daily, you would think that the trans population in the country was 30% or more, the way that people are so upset about this.
Yes. You would think that defining a woman was somehow a very, very complicated thing. Bottom line is that we know that concepts of femininity and masculinity vary from culture to culture,
yes,
even within the United States. They'll vary from rural areas to city areas. But at the center of the issue, there's a basic biological component that is constant. Society has had no problem in defining what makes a male and what makes a female for thousands of years. It's incredible that it's suddenly become so complicated. And I think it's become so complicated because there are powerful political lobby groups that have invested so much in making it complicated.
Right.
Where women are concerned, it's been pretty clear from culture to culture that the biological makeup of the human body is very, very important to distinguish us in terms of our biological sex. And the detachment of gender from sex, that's a new innovation based upon some interesting philosophies that have developed over the last 60, 70 years.
Yes.
There's a tendency in Western culture and thought to be tearing down, it seems, every bastion of solidity, maybe the things that we would have looked at as a culture as things to hang our hat on, like institutions, schools, churches. Now we look at something like, is it, we have sexual identity, then we have, you know, gender identity. I guess I just want your perspective on this larger movement. It just seems like there's very little solid ground.
Yeah, but I think we're living at a time where traditional institutions are plunging into crisis for a whole variety of reasons. Some of them cultural, some of them technological. If we were trying to find the philosophical core of it, I think we understand human beings in a wrong way. We tend to think of ourselves as free and autonomous, and therefore we tend to think that anything embodying external authority is always potentially problematic and inhibiting us from being ourselves, and that makes us into very iconoclastic creatures.
Mm-hmm.
We could think of ourselves as dependent and connected to others. Then I think that iconoclasm wouldn't disappear completely, because some things need to be changed, but I think it would dramatically reduce the iconoclastic mentality that we have towards outside external authority.
The growing pressures of our culture and the sexual revolution have been particularly hard on at least a certain segment of the professing church. Many who want to make peace with the pressures work to accept all things LGBTQ plus, and are, in their own words, deconstructing. Michael Yosef is a voice you might recognize from his program, Leading the Way. He joined Kevin McCullough on AM 570 The Mission in New York City.
Dr. Yosef, since you spoke with me the last time, we've got a lot more problems in the world. I mean, there's a war going on, and there's displaced people, and there's inflation, and we've got bickering and violence here in America, crime out of control. What are you telling the people through your ministry these days about what the God of the Bible says about the times in which we live?
Sure. And many pastors and music Christian musicians are becoming deconstructed.
Yes.
Don't forget that, because that's probably more depressing. And then we have evil forces that are trying to teach our five-year-olds about transgender and homosexuality. I mean, it goes on and on. One of my members reminded me the other day, he said, you know, about 20 years ago, He said, it's going to get darker. And you've been saying this. And he said, I honestly didn't think it's going to be as dark as this. I said, well, probably it's going to get even darker. But regardless, we ought not to be discouraged because, you know, our Lord has basically warned us. And I wrote a book just recently, came out just 4 weeks ago, called Never Give Up, because people are giving up on the truth of the gospel within the church, inside the church, and all the progressives inside the church, which really is more grieving than when we see it in the secular world.
I find that when people are deconstructing or questioning, it's really just a doorway to want to get out of having that light shine on them. They don't like the light shining, so they say, well, I just need a doorway to get out of this place. Is that your experience as well?
Sure. Well, it's basically a nice way of saying they turn their back on the faith. I mean, deconstruction is just a polite way of saying they become an apostate. Let's just call it what it is. And while I'm not a kind of an in-time preacher, I really do believe that we are heading for something that is eschatological in nature, and nobody knows the hour or the time. But, you know, Jesus actually asked a question in the Gospel of Luke, and he said, when the Son of Man returns, will he find faith upon the earth? That always haunted me. And especially now, as I see people departing from the faith, a wholesale departure by whole denominations as well as non-denominational, which is called evangelical churches. One very prominent mega church pastor said, well, I don't know what sin is, but I know what love is. He doesn't know what sin is, and he doesn't know what the cross is all about, because it's whenever sin is minimized, the cross is trivialized, and that's the reason why so many new church buildings now do not have crosses on them. I feel this is I'm sounding the alarm and saying wake up.
No, I don't think that we can I don't think we can do that too much. How do you encourage those who are desiring to be faithful to stay in
that
path?
Esau sold his birthright for a bowl of soup, and so I'm going to say to people, is it worth it to be liked or popular for the next few years by the pagans, by the evil world, and be a friend of the world, and literally forfeit your heaven, or live for the audience of one, which I call the audience of one, which every one of us are going to have. And once we cease the vision of living this life for the audience of one, when we face to face with Jesus, then we're really going to be more and more, because the flesh and the devil are constantly conspiring to draw us away from the truth. And, you know, is it worth it? Is it worth it? I think that's the question I ask people. Is it worth it that you forfeit your eternity, you know, for the temporary popularity?
Coming up, corporate America begins subsidizing abortion.
It kind of looks like they're trying to show off how progressive they are.
When the Christian Outlook returns in a moment, stay with us.
The Pepperdine Graduate School of Public Policy believes in the calling to politics and public service. As one of the few programs of its kind based at a leading Christian university, we prepare students for exciting careers in this vital arena through a curriculum that combines rigorous study of America's founding principles with the latest tools of policy analysis. The application period for fall 2022 classes has begun, so find out more at pepperdine.edu/SPP. That's pepperdine.edu/SPP.
Welcome back to the Christian Outlook. I'm Georgine Rice. Over the course of the last 2 years, the nation has seen opposing waves of legislation related to abortion. The catalyst was the confirmation of Amy Coney Barrett in October of 2020. Pro-life forces saw an opportunity to overturn Roe v. Wade and have pursued legislation to protect human life. Pro-abortion forces, in turn, have pursued legislation that goes further than Roe in facilitating abortion at any stage of pregnancy. Now, corporate America is getting involved as well. Freelance writer Erica Anderson looked into what Citigroup has provided within their benefits package. She was a guest on The Ride Home with John and Kathy.
Erica, this is, like John said, a whole new way of looking at benefits. But this is in response to the recent law that was passed in Texas protecting unborn children from abortion. I believe it starts at 6 weeks of gestation. But Citigroup has decided, you know, they do business all around the country, all around the world. They decided that they're going to give a benefit to employees who work in Texas. Can you tell us about it?
Yeah, so I think this was recently announced, and in their attempt, I guess, to show their progressive credentials, decided that their health insurance plans are going to include money that will cover accommodations and travel for individuals, employees that live in Texas that want to get abortions but can't. And, you know, it kind of looks like they're just trying to show off what they, you know, how progressive they are, but that is what they have announced and included and seem to be very proud of.
Jeez, I mean, I'm sure a tiny percentage of people are going to take them up on this, but it does feel like window dressing, doesn't it? More often than not. Although I guess some people will take this and go and have an abortion on corporate dollars.
Yeah, I mean, I do think it's, you know, it is going to be a small percentage of people. It is, I think, more about them saying something about themselves. And I think even I want to, you know, it seems to be linked back to their CEO, who is a female. And what I discovered in reporting this story is that most of the big companies that are kind of being brazen about, you know, covering abortion and things like that, those CEOs are female, which is just, it's ironic to me that that's the case. But I think she was trying to show off a little bit and led the way with this.
At the same time, I understand that, you know, every statistic I've seen shows that the American public does not agree with Citigroup on this issue. And that they, I think the vast majority, I don't know if it's vast, but I believe the majority of Americans have weighed in and said that they think that abortion should be restricted in the second and third trimester. So maybe you can comment on that, Erica, and how you see the difference in the average American and the cultural elites making these decisions.
Yeah, I mean, I think obviously in the media and in the corporate world, the voices on the far left are very loud. And, you know, you would think if that's all you were looking at, that this represents America. But like you said, when you look at the polling, most people in this country do support abortion restrictions on second and third trimester abortions. And so, but they don't want to talk about that. The media doesn't want to talk about that. But, you know, corporate America doesn't want to talk about that, because the moment that one of them admits that they believe in any kind of restriction, they know that's a trickle down to having to define what is a person and why is it wrong, you know, today and not tomorrow. And so they steer clear of even going near that conversation because it will put them in a catch-22 that they just can't get out of.
Right. The far left, they are extremely vocal in trying to, you know, pin corporate CEOs down into their activist positions. But at the same time, believers and people on the right choose not to speak up. I mean, I guess that's probably the big problem, is that we tend to, you know, shake our head in disgust, but we are not actively pursuing some sort of righteousness here, especially in corporate America. If you have stock in Citibank, then you could show up at the shareholder meeting and speak up.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's a wonderful idea and a great way to make your voice heard. I mean, I think this issue specifically is one that, you know, you're less likely to get canceled speaking about. I know people are always worried about being canceled, and they're fearful for their own jobs for being, you know, blamed for being too politically vocal about something. But I mean, that's a great example of a way that people should speak up. And I would want to encourage people to do that, like employees of Citibank, maybe there would be like a cohort of people that could say something like we're seeing happen at Disney. We're seeing a cohort of people that are conservative Christian folks that don't agree with the direction that Disney's going to. And, you know, Disney doesn't seem to want to respect anything they're saying, but they are still rising up and speaking out. And that is one of the biggest messages I kind of want to carry right now, is that we can't be afraid of being called names. We can't be afraid of the things that are going to be sent our way, because we have to stand up for what we believe in. It matters more than anything right now.
Last question for you, Erica. Talk about what you know about the stats in Texas since the law has been passed. Has it made a difference, or are people just driving out of state?
Yeah, it's definitely made a difference. I believe that in the month after the law was passed, like, recorded abortions were down by like 50%. Yes, people are driving out of state. I actually reported another story about this, about abortion clinics across state lines being completely flooded with people coming in from Texas. But the fact of the matter is a lot of people aren't going to do that or be able to do that. And so it's going to result in a lot more babies being born that would have been aborted.
States like Texas are, in fact, saving lives. But states like Maryland and California are pursuing legislation that would essentially provide for and legitimize infanticide. My colleague Bob Burney found an eerie parallel to a story like that from North Korea.
One particular story is of a woman who was told she had to have an abortion. She refused. She had a forced abortion. The child survived the forced abortion, and the officials took the baby and drowned it in a bucket of water. No, nobody in America would advocate that it's okay for a mother to just allow a child to die. No, that's exactly what the legislation would have allowed. A mother could have a baby, and like with abortion, if this law had passed, up until the day of birth. That would not be a problem. And by the way, that would not be a problem with many on the left. But if that same woman went ahead and gave birth, and 2 weeks later, the mother just allows the child to starve to death or puts it outside the cold to freeze to death. If this legislation had been approved, there could not be prosecution, not even an investigation. If you don't believe me, check it out for yourself. Now, fortunately, there was such enormous pushback, even by liberal Democrats in Maryland, that part of the legislation has now been scrapped. But I promise you, it was there, and it was proposed by a Democratic lawmaker in Maryland. Well, the same kind of legislation is being proposed in California. Postnatal deaths could not be investigated, could not be prosecuted. The liberal progressive left has not been successful to take us to that much of an extreme yet. They want to. They want to take us to that extreme, but they haven't gotten America quite far enough to the left to allow that. But the fact that that kind of legislation has been honestly, intentionally proposed by an elected representative. How then can we look at North Korea and be overly shocked when we actually have elected representatives here in the United States of America that would see no problem with that kind of thing here in America?
Coming up, the beauty of Christ, seen anew through the great poets.
What these poets were taxed with, they were taxed with inventing a new world, a new form of consciousness, a new way of seeing things, and many of them started to reinvent Christianity as an internal religion.
Andrew Klavan, when the Christian Outlook continues in a moment. Stay with us.
Hi, it's Mike Gallagher. I start every day by reading through the stories at Daybreak Insider. In just 10 minutes, I can zip through 10 stories that help me start my day and help shape where I go with the Mike Gallagher Show. Over 250,000 people get Daybreak Insider by email daily, and it's available to you at no cost. Go to daybreakinsider.com and simply plug in your email. That's daybreakinsider.com. In 5 minutes, you will be the most informed person in the office. That's daybreakinsider.com.
Welcome back to the Christian Outlook, brought to you in partnership with the Pepperdine Graduate School of Public Policy. Learn more at publicpolicy.pepperdine.edu. I'm Georgine Rice. Andrew Klavan. For those of you unfamiliar with Mr. Klavan, he's a novelist, a writer of screenplays, and more recently, a writer of nonfiction. What makes Klavan particularly interesting is the fact that he is an adult convert to Christianity. His latest work is called The Truth and Beauty. The subtitle explains his ambitious effort, how the lives and works of England's greatest poets point the way to a deeper understanding of the words of Jesus. Andrew Klavan was a guest of Eric Metaxas.
The book that you've written here, The Truth and the Beauty, what in the world got you to write this? I mean, it's an oblique, strange way into the subject. Yeah. How did you find your way to the subject of this book?
Yeah, I dreaded pitching this book to my agent because I wrote it first, and then I had to find somebody who would handle it and then somebody who would buy it. And it came on me by surprise. I was having a conversation with my son, Spencer, who was a brilliant guy, an Oxford classics PhD and all this. And I was talking to him about how strange a lot of the Gospels are, especially the words of Jesus himself. They're hard to understand. And I said to him, I every time I do understand them, I become more joyful in my life. But a lot of them just kind of strike me as odd. I mean, just basic things that we quote all the time, like love your enemies. Like, I don't even like my enemies. You know?
But it takes a certain level, I would argue, of intellectual self-confidence to say what you just said. In other words, as you say many times in the book, a lot of pastors, maybe they kind of talk around this or they give you the boilerplate answer. But if you're honest about it, I think you have to have a faith that's deep enough to be willing to ask these hard questions, to say, I'm not scared of the questions. My faith is not going to evaporate because I find something difficult. And that's kind of what you do in the book. Like, you look at something and you say what most people are thinking but afraid to think out loud. What is this? This is a weird story. What in the world is Jesus getting at with this? And you ask those questions. But, Andrew, before we really get into the meat of this book, explain to my audience, if you would, who were the Romantic poets? Just because it's your understanding of the history of Romanticism and that movement, which I think I had forgotten 85% of what you say in here. So it's kind of an amazing primer on literary history and history. So talk about that, because it's fascinating. Yeah.
Because the thing you usually hear about the Romantics was there was an age of reason and everybody was reasonable. And then the Romantics came and they reacted and they didn't like reason. They wanted to have emotion, which is utter nonsense. That's not what happened at all. You know, they lived in a time that was so much like our time that it is truly uncanny. I mean, the comparisons are everywhere. They lived in a time when science was changing everything, and so people were losing their faith. The structures of the world, church and state, were collapsing and being shown up as unable to take them into the new era.
And just to be clear, you're talking about the latter part of the 18th century. So this is the lead up to the French Revolution. I mean, a level of chaos on the continent, just hard for us to imagine what that would have been like. But that's what you talk about.
Right. And just like we had a kind of cultural revolution in the 60s where everybody thought it was going to be the age of Aquarius, they thought the French Revolution was going to bring paradise. And instead, it devolved into, obviously, the terror and then a world war. The Napoleonic Wars went all over Europe and Egypt, and they were all over the place for 12 years. And people, just in the way that people could not accept that the Soviet Union's collapse meant that socialism and communism didn't work, radicals on the continent could not admit that the French Revolution had failed. And anybody who said it failed, like the great poet William Wordsworth, was canceled, literally canceled. They came after you in every journal they could. They wrote famous poems about Wordsworth, about what a bad guy he was because he became a conservative after the revolution failed. People started questioning gender roles, whether marriage was a good thing, not just whether marriage was a good thing, but whether women should be able to sleep around at the same level that men had been doing. They began to question God. That to me is the center of it, that they were losing faith in God. Intellectuals, just like now, it was kind of became a default setting for intellectuals to question certainly organized religion and possibly God. And so what these poets were taxed with, they were taxed with inventing a new world, a new form of consciousness, a new way of seeing things. And many of them started to reinvent Christianity as an internal religion. Instead of talking about the man's relationship to God, they started talking about man's relationship to himself and his relationship to nature. And C.S. Lewis, the great Christian apologist, read Wordsworth and he said, yes, if you follow this train of thought, you will be converted. And that's what happened to Wordsworth. Wordsworth was converted. And at the heart of all of them, I think, he sort of becomes the anti-hero, the hero of the book, but he was such a mess. So Samuel Coleridge, who was the most brilliant man of his generation, one of the most brilliant men who ever lived. He almost knew everything. He was the one guy that knew that Jesus Christ was at the center of their search. And he went from writer to writer to writer, talked incessantly, and changed all of them. And sometimes, you know, he brought them just a new way of seeing things.
Coming up, appreciating the Gospels in new ways, finding Christ anew and afresh.
It's not that it changes the old things that you know. It's simply more. It simply expands it.
More with Andrew Klavan when the Christian Outlook returns in a moment. Stay with us.
The Pepperdine Graduate School of Public Policy believes in the calling to politics and public service. As one of the few programs of its kind based at a leading Christian university, we prepare students for exciting careers in this vital arena through a curriculum that combines rigorous study of America's founding principles with the latest tools of policy analysis. The application period for fall 2022 classes has begun, so find out more at pepperdine.edu/SPP. That's pepperdine.edu/SPP.
Welcome back to the Christian Outlook. I'm Georgine Rice. We see today in our nation, and more broadly in the West, an erosion of norms, of values and ideals that served as the foundation for this great project of liberty, the United States of America. You could say simply that we are in the process of shedding all that reminds us of Christianity. Andrew Clavin sees a parallel here with the era of Romanticism. These great poets, he argues, found a way back to Christ and back to Christianity amidst the chaos of their own moment in history. We'll pick up with Andrew Clavin talking to Eric Metaxas about his new book, The Truth and Beauty.
What happened to me is when I went back to the Gospels to try and understand them, I realized these guys had built a road back to the Gospels from a place very much like the place where we live. And I started to think, well, if you follow that road, maybe you come back to the Gospels and see them in a new way. And that's what happened to me, that I started to read the words of Jesus in a genuinely new way. And it's not that it changes the old things that you know. It's simply more. It simply expands it. Because the thing that I don't think Jesus was saying was be nice or you'll be punished. And if you're nice, you'll get a big reward. That's not what I think he was actually saying. I don't think we needed the king of our universe to do what he did, give us that piece of information. He was telling you a way, he was giving you a way of seeing things. You know, there's all these lines in the Gospels that you forget about, like where he says, I want the joy that's in me to be in you. You stop and think about that for a minute and think, like, do the Christians I know have the joy that is in Jesus in them? And joy, I don't use the word joy to mean happiness. You know, it's not like you're supposed to walk around with a big grin on your face when things are falling apart. It's what the poets called gusto. You're supposed to live as if it matters, as if every minute you're alive is important and exciting and interesting, even when it is incredibly painful and full of suffering. And the poets actually teach that. And when you read what they say and you go back to Jesus, you realize he's taking it to even the next level.
There is so much in this book. As I say, I read the whole book yesterday, so it can't be that long.
No.
But it is just loaded with, just your bringing to life characters like Samuel Taylor Coleridge and Keats, and just to see them as human beings, and that alone is a high recommendation. I want to say congratulations on really having the guts to write this book, because I can see how a lot of editors or publishers would try to steer you in different directions. And you obviously said to them, shut up, here's the book. And I'm so glad you did.
There's only one editor that I could have think of when I finished it. And I put, as you know, I put a lot of work into it. I thought, gee, if this one editor turns this down, I simply don't know where else I'll go. So Webster Younce, he's now the publisher of Zondervan, but he was my editor on my memoir, and he took it instantly. Shocking.
Well, I'm not surprised. That he would be the one that I would suggest, and God bless him. For doing that, because this is an important book. And I think that you're, as I said, the level of writing, what you get into, what really delighted me was, I mentioned this earlier, how you bring to life figures that I didn't really think of biographically. I mean, somebody mentions Coleridge. Okay, I've heard of The Rime of the Ancient Mariner. You mentioned Keats. These are figures that I had not really come to appreciate as human beings, just as these names behind poems.
I'm really glad you bring this up, because the whole thing was, I know that people don't read poetry. Poetry is dead. The art of poetry is for people like me who study English literature and who love English literature, but most people don't read it. And I didn't want you to have to know poetry or even like it to get into what I was saying. And these people lived some of the most interesting lives in literary history. There were six of the greatest poets who have ever lived, living on the island, the British island at the same time. They were geniuses. They were drug addicts. They were, scoundrels. They were brilliant. They fought with each other. They yelled at each other. I mean, book starts with a wild, drunken party they were all at. That's in the whole books have been written about this party. So I just wanted to get you into their minds so that you could see that what they were doing, this challenge of rebuilding the consciousness of human beings for the modern age, was a dramatic human challenge taken on by dramatic humans. And it's the thing about intellectual life when it's lived at that level is it's just as exciting as being an explorer or being a soldier or any of the things that we
Except
tell stories
I would say
about.
This is more dangerous. I mean, when I look at the lives that are destroyed, when you think of a Byron, Mary Shelley, it's an interesting thing because we have seen it in our time. You parallel this era of the Romantics, you know, from a little bit over 200 years ago with the modern era and the 60s. And we all see lives that have been destroyed, the abortions, the broken hearts, the drug deaths, right? It's very similar what you're writing about. I mean, when you talk about, you know, Byron's sister and all of this, I mean, it's kind of funny because it is Byronesque. It is, you know, the romantic poet, the Byronic hero living for himself. It's kind of like a Nietzschean Übermensch before Nietzsche, right? Just breaking all the rules and destroying humans in his wake, just leaving humans in his wake. But these are amazing stories. And I know a number of these stories have been told here and there. But you, let's just talk about Coleridge, for example. I really knew nothing about Coleridge. And you, I mean, is there anybody funnier, more entertaining, more crazy, amazing, beautiful than Samuel Coleridge? We should all know who he is, and you bring him to life.
Yeah, and there are long paragraphs written about how much he talked. Just people were absolutely stunned by the wave of conversation that came off him. And every single one of them was changed. You know, when he met Wordsworth, when he first really got friendly with Wordsworth, Wordsworth was lost. You know, he was kind of Coleridge called him a semi-atheist. He didn't know how to deal with the failure of the French Revolution. He had been a radical, and now all his radical dreams were gone. He didn't have any money. He didn't know where he was going. After a year of listening to Coleridge pound him with talk, he became the greatest poet of his generation. And it was clearly from a collaboration with Coleridge that he had this vision of the human mind as being in collaboration essentially with God, as he called it, with the one great mind, and that your life is a creation, is part of creation, is your life is continued creation. That was Coleridge's idea that became Wordsworth's idea. When he met Keats, Keats was on the verge of death. Keats died a very, very young man, one of the most tragic stories in the book. And Keats was frozen. He was lost. And he had an hour, 2 hour talk with Coleridge walking in the park, came back, and in a couple of months wrote five or six of the greatest poems ever written, really the greatest poetry since Shakespeare. And everything that Coleridge touched, this broken man, this drug addict, this hysteric, this guy whose marriage was miserable, everything he touched became magic, just lit up. And even Mary Shelley, I have a chapter on Mary Shelley's Frankenstein. She was a little girl, and Coleridge came over her house and recited the Rime of the Ancient Mariner. And it's, if you look at Frankenstein, the novel Frankenstein, is filled with Coleridge. I mean, Coleridge is all through it. So he just changed everybody.
Coming up,
you are a God-made machine for finding the truth.
A few more minutes with Andrew Klavan. In the final segment of The Christian Outlook, stay with us.
Hi, it's Mike Gallagher. I start every day by reading through the stories at Daybreak Insider. It's a look at today's most compelling stories and provides responses from key conservatives in media and politics. Over 250,000 people get Daybreak Insider by email daily, and it's available to you at no cost. Go to daybreakinsider.com and simply plug in your email. That's daybreakinsider.com. In 5 minutes, you will be the most informed person in the office. That's daybreakinsider.com.
Welcome back to The Christian Outlook. I'm Georgine Rice. When we look at various writers, artists, and key cultural figures of the distant past, we tend to see them as isolated figures from their creative works as standalone pieces, not grounded in their time and space or in history. For many of us, that is simply because we don't have an adequate understanding of history, context, and the various characters that created these works that have stood the test of time. Now, let's return for a few more minutes of Eric Metaxas with Andrew Klavan on the truth and beauty.
Andrew, part of the fun of this book is being reminded of all these characters and how they interacted with each other, because, you know, we think of them as names in the pantheon, right. You know. But the idea that John Milton, who precedes all of these figures, and how his work led to some of them, I guess it was Wordsworth, right, who was obsessed with Milton.
Yeah, he wanted to rewrite basically Paradise Lost, the story of the fall of man, Milton's brilliant poem on the fall of man. He kind of wanted to rewrite it as a mental event, and he never quite got around to it. He never quite did it, but he was obsessed with becoming the new
Milton. Aren't you glad he didn't? It's kind of funny. But just the way they all interacted with each other, we forget really that that was the case. You also talk about Keats. I mean, my goodness, he died at age 25. You think he was the greatest poetic genius since Shakespeare. Now, there are a lot of poetic geniuses out there. What makes you kind of, you know, put him up there at the top of the pantheon?
It was really the truth and beauty. His poetry is so beautiful to read and so dense, so packed with meaning, the way Shakespeare's is, that you could hesitate between two words without ever getting to the end of the way they reverberate off each other. The title of the book comes from him, from his Ode on a Grecian Urn, in which he's basically contemplating how art leads us into eternity. And the Grecian Urn says at the end of the poem to humankind, it says, "Beauty is truth. Truth, beauty, that's all you know on earth and all you need to know." And that line, just like the lines in the gospel, always puzzled me. But as you read Keats's letters and you read more about what he was thinking, you realize that the kind of beauty he's talking about is not prettiness. It's not kind of something that you might have one thing that you like and I have something else that I like. It's this great shock of understanding that what you are seeing in front of you somehow resonates with a greater truth than what you're actually seeing with your eyes. And that moment, it kind of tells you that you are a God-made machine for finding the truth. And the reason that matters is we're living in a world right now where your inner life is either dismissed as subjective and therefore untrue, or it's elevated to the point of reality so that I can say, oh, guess what, Eric, I just turned into a woman, and now you have to call me a woman because my inner life is sovereign. And what all three poets, Coleridge, Wordsworth, and Keats, were saying is, no, you're in a collaboration with reality. Your inner life is a new creation out of the reality that you have. And if it's not in keeping with the reality that is out there, with God's creation, then it's not beautiful and it's not true. But when it is, you get this shock of beauty that is what poetry gives you and what real awake life gives you as well.
Thank you for joining us for the Christian Outlook. For more of that conversation, go to ChristianOutlook.com. And while you're there, remember to subscribe to our podcast. Thank you for joining us today. Our program has been brought to you in part through our partnership with the Pepperdine Graduate School of Public Policy. I'm Georgine Rice. Join us again next time for the Christian Outlook.
Three-star general Michael J. Flynn, head of the Pentagon Intelligence Agency, knew all the government's dirty secrets.
He was one of the most respected generals in the military.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to. He understood its funding.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
The explosive new documentary, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, and covers the facts behind this scandal.
Flynn told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire.
I find out the worst enemy that I'm going to face in my life is right here in America. They took my assessment and they wanted me to change it. And I was like, I'm not changing it.
They had to get rid of Flynn.
With in-depth interviews, archival footage, and never before seen personal records of the man behind the headlines.
I just felt like I was drowning.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to salemnow.com. Salemnow.com.